Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Daniel Foster of National Review Online, in for Jim Garrity. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And, Dan, let's start with the speech that everyone was anticipating in the political world, thinking maybe it was a sign that Chris Christie was jumping into the presidential race. And, well, just like every other response he's ever given to that question, he's absolutely not going to do it. He says he doesn't feel like this is the race he needs to get into, that he doesn't feel called to join this race. But what he did do is give an amazing speech, essentially centered around American exceptionalism, which was very appropriate given the setting at the Reagan Library. It was certainly reminiscent of how Ronald Reagan felt about this country and led this country. But I think the quote that's probably going to get the most attention today is how he completely shredded 2004 and 2008 Barack Obama compared to what we're seeing from him right now. He quoted verbatim Obama from his keynote address at the 2004 Democratic Convention that nominated John Kerry, saying there's not a conservative America and a liberal America. There's a United States of America. There's not a white, a black, an Asian, a Latino America. There's a United States of America. And he says now all of a sudden it's only division that Obama is relying on to win re-election.
7 years later, President Obama prepares to divide our nation to achieve re-election. This is not a leadership style. This is a re-election strategy. Telling those who are scared and struggling that the only way their lives can get better is to diminish the success of others. Trying to cynically convince those who are suffering that the American economic pie is no longer a growing one that can provide more prosperity for all who work hard. Insisting that we must tax and take and demonize those who have already achieved the American dream.
Mitt Romney, Rick Perry, Herman Cain, whoever's in the running against Barack Obama in 2012, copyright that. Take it and run with it. That is perfect illustration of what Obama is doing here. I can see why people want Christie to run when he can distill things so well, but I don't think it should be that hard for the Republican nominee to point that out, because it's blatantly true and Obama can only stammer in response to it.
This speech was the most philosophical that I've heard Christie. You know, he's a very solutions-oriented guy, a very what-are-we-going-to-do-about-it kind of guy, but he kind of took a step back and talked about first principles last night. Also, as I remarked, reading the advanced copy of the speech, I don't think Chris Christie's going to run for president. I haven't for a long, long time. But I'll tell you what, this speech certainly sounds like a guy who's known for his domestic policy credentials, trying to lay out a foreign policy vision, and an interesting one at that, if vague. And it also sounds like a guy who's taken shots at the President of the United States because for some strange reason he feels like that might be an important thing for him to do. He has plans coming up in the future that might require him to make a credible case against the president, so he figured he might as well get that started. Now, like I said, I don't think he's actually going to run. But the speech certainly makes it sound like he is. And I'll tell you, I'm torn, because as much as I've thought this Christie buzz is kind of a media-created frenzy, and as much as I've thought it's kind of reached a level of parity in the last couple of weeks, considering, as Christie himself pointed out, Politico was able to string together two straight minutes of no's from Christie over the last 2 years. So part of me thinks it's silly. And yet I have to also admit, after watching him last night and people, you know, people going on Twitter and people blogging all over left and right saying, well, he didn't definitively say no. You know, I should want to laugh at that. But to be honest with you, I kind of think they're right. He did kind of leave the door open. And I'm sensitive to the suggestion. You know, somebody said, I forget who, but somebody said, if Chris Christie actually lit himself on fire, people would be wondering what that meant about his decision to run. You know, so I think in one way, there's no way people are going to stop thinking about this until we actually hold a vote in Iowa, and maybe after that. But I think it was a great night for the governor, whether or not he decides to run.
The nominee could be all sewn up. Chris Christie will probably get a pretty nice slot at the convention. And after the speech, the speculation will still be there that there could be a floor revolt or something like that. But on to a topic completely different than American exceptionalism and freedom and everything that Ronald Reagan stood for and Chris Christie articulated so well on Tuesday night is our second martini. This comes from Peter Orszag, who you may remember was President Obama's director of the Office of Management and Budget director, essentially, for the first year and change of his administration. And he wrote a piece recently for The New Republic, not exactly a right-of-center publication, but he starts out with a quote from John Adams saying, there was never a democracy that did not commit suicide. And I think most people would argue that the reason that that's the case is because people realize they can just vote themselves more money and those countries go bankrupt. But what he says, how to solve the paralyzing gridlock that is the result of Washington's inability to do its basic work. We need to minimize the harm from legislative inertia by relying more on automatic policies and depoliticized commissions for certain policy decisions. In other words, radical as it sounds, we need to counter the gridlock of our political institutions by making them a bit less democratic. Dan, I don't know how much more scary or wrongheaded or disgusting this administration can get when it feels like it hasn't been wielding enough power. And clearly, it's basically a shot across the bow of the American people. You don't appreciate this big government agenda that we have, which is clear from the last election. So I guess the only response we can have is to give you less power.
There's so much that's wrong and, as you say, scary about this statement. We don't have the time, nor do I, frankly, have the energy to get into all of it. But let me just say a couple of things. One is that the idea that there is such a thing as a depoliticized commission and a technocratic, rational, middle-of-the-road, almost mechanical solution to these complex moral, philosophical, economic, and policy problems, issues of fairness, issues of our priorities, issues of the kind of country we want to be, the illusion that we can solve these problems by a couple of formula on a chalkboard is at the heart of the liberal disease and always has been. And so this is actually a profound statement of something that's been essential to progressivism, even when progressivism is also somewhat contradictorily arguing for more democratic participation and not less. So that's one thing. The second thing is this kind of gives up another central problem with the progressive agenda as it's been practiced in this country, is that when you rely on people's sense of fear and their sense of entitlement and of protecting what they've been given by the state over the last 70, 80 years of the welfare state, and then you demagogue on those things to get them to continue to vote for you, well, you now have an irrational electorate, an electorate that's perhaps less capable than it used to be of seeing what's right for the republic, of seeing what's best for them in the long run, what's best for their children in the long run, and increasingly concerned with being conservative in the worst possible sense of that term, by which I mean protecting the expansive subsidy and entitlement state that's been created over the last three quarters of a century. I would agree with Orszag that, you know, there's certainly cases where democracy can be frustrating because we have this electorate, or at least a chunk of it. We pray every 2 years that it's not the majority, but we have this electorate that sees, its interests in big government and says, you know, I'm going to protect what's mine and vote accordingly. And that can create some less than optimal outcomes for the republic. But one thing I do know is that the solution to that is not increased government power. The solution to that is liberating people to make their own decisions so they have to care about these things.
Very well said. And I think it's worth pointing out that gridlock, to a large extent, was kind of what the founders wanted. They wanted it to be hard to ram all these things through, which is why gridlock was much preferable to what we saw in the previous Congress.
Absolutely. I cringe when people say, oh, if only we had a parliamentary system where the government could turn on a dime, where one day all of Congress and the executive could be pointed straight left, and the next day it could be pointed straight right. That terrifies me. The fact that we're a slow, lumbering, difficult to maneuver state is probably what's kept us from crumbling.
And then, of course, you have the governor of North Carolina suggesting that we just skip the next congressional election because politics intervene too often. So we'll just
see. I think that a lot of my readers would agree with that. They disagree with one thing. We'd skip the next election, but we wouldn't extend the terms of the current members of Congress.
I think that's exactly right. And that whole pesky Article 1, we don't really need to follow that anyway. Anyway, on to Martini number three now, and on to more government intervention, shock, shock, coming from this administration. And, of course, the latest one comes from the Obama administration and the Ford Motor Company. If you haven't seen these commercials, Ford is talking about its resurgent sales, and they bring in these car owners. They say that they're real interviews. I don't know if they're scripted or not. But anyway, they come in and explain why they bought their Ford. Here's this guy named Chris, and here's the first question that he's asked in this mock press conference.
Chris, was it buying American important to you?
I wasn't going to buy another car that was bailed out by our government. I was going to buy from a manufacturer that's standing on their own, win, lose, or draw. That's what America's about, is taking the chance to succeed and understanding when you fail that you got to pick yourself up and go back to work. Ford is that company for me.
No, that guy's not voting for Obama next year, I can tell you that. But this commercial was in the rotation, and then all of a sudden some questions were asked by the Obama administration, pointing out the fact that, in truth, Ford did support the bailouts for their competitors. Ford now saying that they weren't pressured to remove it, but it's pretty clear that they were.
There's some dispute over just how much contact there was between the White House and Ford. But as I wrote in a post yesterday, getting a call, even if the White House didn't say you got to pull this ad, getting a call from the White House and asking quote-unquote questions is, of course, a form of pressure in and of itself. I likened it to, you know, getting visited by Tommy Hagen in The Godfather, getting visited by Robert Duvall. You know, he's all smiles and honest questions and can you do me a favor? But you know that there's a horse's head in your bed lying behind that smile, right? So I mean, it's its own brand of pressure. The White House makes a semi or what appears to be a superficially legitimate point, which is that Ford's CEO supported the bailouts of his competitors, even though he didn't take money. So their semi-legitimate point there is that this guy is a supporter of the policy and now the company is using the policy to sell cars. You know, there's some superficial truth to that, but also if you go back and you look at that time and place, Mulally, the CEO of Ford, he's trying to protect his supply chains. He knows how disastrous it would be for Ford, which didn't make all these terrible decisions and didn't screw up like GM and Chrysler did. He knows how disastrous it would be for him if those other two companies went down. He'd lose his supply chains and things would be bad for him. So he was kind of put in this position. And of course, just like with the banks, I'm sure we know this happened with the banks, and I'm sure it happened with the autos, that there was pressure from the federal government that if one or two were getting on board, that they all get on board. So, you know, the CEO of Ford had to march down to Washington just like the other two CEOs and get ridiculed for taking his private jet, if you recall. He had to go down there even though he wasn't asking for a bailout and kind of, you know, show some solidarity with his competitors. I give that guy a little leeway. I give Ford leeway for supporting the bailout. It's not perfect, but I totally understand it. It's unfortunate, though, to see them kind of lose the spine and lose the thing that set them apart from their competitors and pull this commercial in response to quote-unquote questions from the White House.
We'll leave it there. I'm sure we'll have three great topics again tomorrow. Dan, thanks for your time.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Daniel Foster of National Review Online. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.